Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced 4 documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers out here. Back in the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio, Studio 4, in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City. Within blocks of several mob hits in Midtown Kansas City. We can just drive 3 blocks down the street to where Mr. O'Brien's was and see where Sonny Bowen got hit. Anyhow, we are in, I don't know exactly which part of the series we'll be in, but we're still in the media and the mob series with this, string of, interviews of reporters who covered the mob in Kansas City, Philadelphia, Chicago, Las Vegas. And I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, who we have on the line tonight is kind of a celebrity, a Kansas City celebrity, if you will, for years and years. I've read his byline many, many times, Mr. Harry Jones. And I want to tell you a little bit about Harry before we get him on. He was one of the founding members of Investigative Reporters and Editors, which you may not be familiar with that, but it was developed as a tool for investigative reporters, mob reporters throughout the United States to help each other investigate the mob in the different cities. Harry was part of the founding of that, which makes me say he's like a hero in the reporting world, the mob reporting world. And you know, folks, and I've said this before, that the mob reporters were every bit as important as the police in many ways, because the mob only works if nobody knows what they're doing and nobody ever talks about it. And the police were willing to go out and investigate it and talk about it. But the mob reporters, without guns, with pens and reporter notebooks and just their guts and their enthusiasm and their intelligence, were able to go out and find people to talk about the mob and put it in the paper. So they shined a light on mob activities. We've got Harry on the line right now, calling in from his beautiful retirement home. Say hello to everybody, Harry.
All right.
Good to have you here. We are, we talked to one of your proteges the other day, Bill Norton. I'm sure I know you remember him. He learned everything he knew, he said, from you. He learned a little bit in journalism school too, and from other reporters. He learned a little bit from J.J. Maloney. We talked about him a little bit, who has quite an interesting story himself. You probably can add to that story, because you were a little bit more instrumental in getting him out of the penitentiary and into the newspaper business, from what Bill said. But, you know, what I really want to talk about first is IRE, Investigative Reporters and Editors, and you were part of the founding of that. Can you tell our folks just a little bit about that?
Well, a group of investigative reporters who were traditionally talking to each other on the phone anyway, comparing notes and so forth, finally got the idea in 1975, I guess it was, to form an organization. And I was one of the first members. But by sheer coincidence, as we were getting things to form together and planning the first convention, Don Bowles was murdered, and a reporter for the Arizona Republic was murdered in Arizona. And it was decided to form what we call the Arizona Project. And it was to send as many reporters as we could get together down into Arizona and not solve his murder. That was a police job, but to carry on his work. He covered the mob, among other things, and it was quite well known in Arizona and respected. So in 76, we descended upon Phoenix, and working in shifts, like I was there for 4 weeks, 2 weeks at a time, once 2 weeks to gather the news and 2 weeks to help write. And at the end of the project, we published an enormously long series of articles about crime, not just organized crime, but all sorts of crime in Arizona. And the IRS had its convention in the meantime, and it was off to a good start, and it's grown and is now an incredibly important organization in journalism. For people who like to dig into subjects, and through them they can compare notes and draw on the files that are enormous now. And it's just a great organization, which I have been proud to be a member of for as long as I was in journalism.
Well, you know, in police intelligence units, we have a national organization called the LEIU, or Law Enforcement Intelligence Units. And that was formed because, for some of the same reasons, because a lot of these professional criminals and the higher end in the crime world, they move from city to city, and they will have connections. You know, people from Kansas City will have connections in Las Vegas or San Diego or Los Angeles or Chicago, and people in Chicago will have connections, you know, in Kansas City and Cleveland and Milwaukee and maybe even down into right. Texas or St. Louis. So we could, if we had a lead that went off to, say, Chicago, well, you can't just call the Chicago Police Department general number and find anybody that's going to help you. No. But we could call a member agency of the LEIU, which the Chicago PD Intelligence would have been a member agency. We could call them, and they understood who we were, and we knew who they were, and they would go out and run down that lead for us and get back to us. Did it work kind of like that?
Right. Exactly. You described it well.
So, you know, I was looking over this Don Bowles, and I understand you all didn't go down there, but you probably, to solve his murder, it did end up getting solved. He was killed with a remote control bomb with 6 sticks of dynamite taped to the underside of his car. But he had, his last words were John Adamson, Emprise, and Mafia. So these cryptic kind of clues. Now, it wasn't the Mafia that killed him, from what I read about it. It was, but he had written a lot about land fraud down there in the southwest part of the United States. So did you guys get into any of those land fraud cases and expose some of that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we wrote about the whole, Bowles had exposed a certain businessman down in Arizona as having, you know, I don't remember the details, but this man sued us. His name was Kemper Marley, as I recall. He has sued the IRE after we came out with our series because he had been named by two men who had been, it was complicated. Anyway, he didn't like what we wrote. He sued us. We spent long hours. And it was the only time I've ever sued for a libel. 40 of us together. And we won the case and got free legal service out of it, too. It was a very nice thing. But anyway, the theory was that Bowles was killed mainly because of articles he had written exposing this businessman's tie to the mob. Two men were convicted and sent to prison, but later they won freedom on appeal.
Yeah, that was John Harvey Adamson. He's a name that Bowles mentioned as he was dying,
and
he was one that served the time for planting the bomb.
He lured him to the parking lot and planted the bomb. But Don, it took him 11 days to die, and they kept having to amputate limbs, both legs and an arm before he was finally dead. It was just a terrible, horrible way to go. And I knew Don. We had gone to the same college. In fact, I knew his sister quite well. We worked together on the campus newspaper, Boyd College in Wisconsin. Really fine guy.
So I guess my question would be, Harry, how did you get started reporting on organized crime in Kansas City?
Well, I was a general assignment reporter, and in 1959, if you recall, City Hall was taken over by what we call the Democratic factions, the Citizens Association people who had run City Hall since 1940. Were finally swept out of office, and a majority on the city council was they were not of high quality, and we were concerned that, among other things, the mafia had its foot in the door with these two of the North Side political organization run by Alex Presta. And so I was assigned to kind of keep an eye on what's going on at City Hall from that perspective. What were the bad guys trying to do? If one of the things they were trying to do was return the city to the spoil system, especially in, among other places, the fire department. And that's how I ended up reporting on the mob. The Teamsters Union was trying to take over the fire department, take from the International Association of Firefighters, and that got to be a real brawl, and I was covering that every day. And in the process, at one point, Ben Gladden, the president of the union, revealed that Corky Sabella, Nick Sabella's older brother, had offered him a high position in the fire department, I think battalion chief, if he would knuckle under to the Teamsters Union. And of course, Stan said no, he was a good union man. And if you recall, he was later, an attempt was made on his life, and a bomb went off in his car, and his ankles were shattered, but he miraculously escaped death. Anyway, I was somehow, I don't remember how, but I ended up downtown one Saturday talking to Corky Sabella, who I'd never met before and hardly knew. All I knew was that his brother, Nick, had been caught in Appalachian, New York in 1957 after the famous gangland meeting there of all the mafia types. And ever since they caught him there, him and one other Kansas Cityan, well, he was regarded as a man to watch in organized crime in Kansas City. Of course, he was the leader of it for a long time. Anyway, I talked to Corky off the record for probably an hour and a half. And he didn't say anything. But I can't even really tell you or remember what the conversation was. I was so, one, amazed that he would talk to me, and two, amazed at what he was saying. And it just got me interested. And at the same, about this time, Al DeLugich, who was a great reporter for the Star and doing the mob into the late 70s, he left the Star to go to work for the St. Louis Globe Democrat, and I sort of inherited his beat. It was sort of an operation by osmosis. There was no critical moment when I said, they said, you got the mafia now, but all of a sudden I had the beat, and it was interesting. You went on for many years.
Well, you came in at an opportune time, that's for sure, because they're late 60s, and now starting with the bombing of Stan Gladden and working on into the River Key and the Teamsters, Roy Williams, and all that was popping. Yeah. And that was really, you know, by the middle 70s, that was almost the peak of their, for sure, their financial power. And they had a lot of political power there late in the 60s, and then that started waning in the 70s. So you really got to see the whole arc of the Kansas City mob and kind of a front row seat.
Well, We had a crusading editor named Richard Fowler, who was president of the paper in the early 60s. And he was determined to return good government to City Hall. And then after he did that in 1963, only one of the incumbents won. All the others were beaten. And so then he turned his eyes on the county. And again, the mob had its ties to the courthouse. And so I was working that for a while. And in 66, I think it was, they assigned me to do a history of the mafia. I wrote an incredibly long piece that ran in the paper. And then I did some biographies of Nick and Max Jabin and Alex Presta that attracted some attention. Anyway, before that was all over, the county had sort of been cleaned up too. The prosecutor's office was made a little bit more honest. And the North Side influence was dissipated.
Yeah, they still had a couple. They still had old Harry Mazzucci on the bench over there. Romano, I can't think of his first name now. The Judge Romano, the guy that later on he would take $100,000+ in 20s and 50s and 100s from a drug dealer when he sold him a club out there on Armor in Maine. So they kept some hooks into the county courthouse. I heard this story. I'm sure you remembered. You might even been in the hallway that Corky Savella came out of a grand jury hearing and exposed himself to a group of policemen and reporters that were out there. Do you remember that one?
Well, I sure do. He grabbed his penis and waved it at the camera and said, "Here, take a picture of this." And see, the Channel 5 did just that. And so they arrested the cameraman and charged him with invading the privacy of Mr. Savella.
Wait, he was in a hallway at a courthouse.
Instead of charging Savella with indecent exposure.
That must have been county sheriffs that did that, not Kansas City police.
I was going to say, that was kind of public property, isn't it? You can film legally.
He went before a city judge, and the city judge found him guilty.
Really? I did not know that. Wow, that's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Did they say, "Let me see the footage first"?
I don't know if they bothered to see the footage.
He was inches away from a crime.
It was all very suspicious.
It was. It was almost like a setup or something.
I know. I talked with a nephew of Tuffy DeLuna who said when Cork came out of prison that he lived it up those last few years.
He did what? He lived it up, you say?
Yeah. I have somebody that I know who's a nephew of Tuffy DeLuna. And every once in a while we get a little bit of a conversation. And, of course, he always wants to say, why don't they tell a good story about the mob? And I can't disagree with that. And so when we talked with Bill Norton, I asked the same question. Why don't they ever tell a good story about the mob, the good things they do? And, of course, the answer is if it bleeds, it leads.
But that wasn't really his answer. That was my answer.
Yeah. But I mean, Cork flashing or waving his penis around it, folks. There's a good story.
So, if as a reporter, did you ever feel threatened by these guys?
When I started getting into that, my desk was next to a reporter named Ira McCarty, who had covered the mob in the 30s and 40s. In fact, he was so involved in it that when Kefauver came to Kansas City with his crime commission, Ira and his partner wrote most of the questions for the senators to ask. And he assured me, said, "Don't worry, as long as you're working for the paper, they're not going to do anything to you. It's bad for business." And I kind of took that to heart, and so I didn't worry too much. I worried a little, but not too much. And they were smart enough. I think Nick Savella was smart enough to know that you don't go around knocking off reporters if you want to retain a low profile in the community.
That was kind of the difference in the two brothers. You know, Nick was really the head, the boss, or the godfather, or whatever you want to call him, of the Kansas City family. And his brother Cork, he was called Cork because he would pop off a lot. He had a quick temper, and that was the difference. Yeah. Nick said, you know, keep everything low profile. Just stay under the radar, you know, dress normally, have normal cars, normal houses, and don't go out here and create scenes anywhere. But Cork would create a scene and had a he always had a Lincoln and dressed a lot fancier and created scenes everywhere he went.
And he would talk to you, and when he was waiting outside grand juries, he would let forth with his wisdom.
Yeah, Nick,
not shy.
Nick would not talk to you. He wouldn't even acknowledge you, would he?
God, I went out to Liberty, Missouri one day when he was appearing before a grand jury there, a Clay County grand jury, and I tried to interview him, and he asked the deputy sheriff to protect him from my harassment. So then he sat down in the courthouse. There's a big, huge lobby, and he sat down on one of the benches, and I went over and sat in the opposite bench on the other side of the room, and we just stared at each other for about an hour, and that was it. He never gave me the time of day.
Yeah, see, Cork couldn't have taken it. He'd have had to just start at least mentioned the weather or something with you.
Yeah, Cork wasn't this smart.
Yeah. That's why his brother was the boss. Matter of fact, when we started getting all the murders in the 70s, that's because Nick was getting sick and he was in the penitentiary there for about 2.5 years, 1973, 74, and they started knocking people off like crazy.
Yeah.
When you were reporting, were you just mostly pen and paper, or did you ever get a microphone, like the tape recorder, ever get them to ever say anything to you?
No.
No.
Not on mob stories, anyway.
What about sources? Did you...
How would you develop a source? I mean, you'd see some of these guys hanging close to Cork and Tuffy and
I never Nick. I never got anybody really close, but I had some good, very good law enforcement sources that helped. And then there were a few people around town, like Jerry Brooks.
I want to talk to you about Jerry Brooks. Let's. What about in the city hall? I bet you in the county courthouse. I bet you had a whole raft of clerks and secretaries and people like that that would at least let you know if something was going to happen or something was going on over there, didn't you?
Oh. I don't know. I wouldn't say I would great many know, but there are a few people that I recall from the inside. Very helpful. And of course, you never knew how much to believe them.
Yeah, that's
true. I would never rely on one source for anything I'd print. I had to double check or triple check it before we printed. But...
What about go ahead. I'm sorry, Harry. Go ahead.
Well, one of my problems in covering organized crime was that I am a civil libertarian, and I do not like this guilt by association crap that goes on so much in reporting about criminal matters. And so I was trying to remain true to my ideals on civil liberties when I was in, for instance, when the River Key began to be taken over by mob interests. We found out, J.J. Mulley actually found out about it first, that this was happening. But various people who were related to mob figures were getting liquor licenses because the mob figures couldn't get the licenses, but they were fronts. But we didn't know how many of them were fronts and how many of them were legitimate. And I hesitate to go just assume that if somebody is related, is the nephew or uncle of somebody in the mob, that he is automatically to be considered suspect and willing to do the bidding of that relative. So maybe I could have done a better job if I had been less respectful of the individual.
Well, is it a bit of cynicism on the part of maybe the other people, reporters or the police, the intelligence unit, where their presumption is they're working in association with these known
mobsters? Yeah, and I think it's fair. When you're investigating, you're going to assume a lot of things. And usually you're right, but when it comes down to actually writing it and putting it in the paper, we needed more.
Yeah.
But solid facts.
Sometimes I would think, you're talking about some nefarious activities that nobody really wants to talk about, let alone getting a source to tell you something and then being able to go back and somehow verify it would seem like that. Yeah. That's a lot of work back, certainly before the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, Gary would tell stories of 3x5 cards, and how often would you get one of those from somebody in the police force?
Yeah, Maloney was really hot to trot on running some stories about the mob takeover of the River Key, and they assigned me to be sort of his. He came in with the whole story originally, and he and I investigated, went through liquor department files and so forth. But I remember telling him, we really can't run with this until we know more. Let's just wait till they start killing each other. And by God, I was right. It didn't take long.
Didn't take long, did it? In regards to what you're saying, Harry, you're absolutely right that Freddie Bonadonna was a perfect example. Freddie Bonadonna, a lot of people painted him as a mob guy because his dad was a mob guy, and there's no doubt about it. But Freddie worked, and that's what got his dad killed, was Freddie worked real hard to keep those mob-backed liquor licenses from moving down into the River Key and spoiling the kind of family fun atmosphere that was going on down there, and that's what got him killed. So, a lot of people wanted to paint him with that brush. Now, JJ, he could hang out in those clubs, if I remember right. Now, folks, J.J. Maloney is a really interesting character. I told this story with Bill Norton, but I think he did an armed robbery and killed a clerk or something in St. Louis and went to jail as a really young man, like 18 maybe.
Yeah.
And spent a lot of time in the penitentiary, he got connected with the Kansas City Star because he could write. He wrote poems and sent them up to the Star, and they kind of took him under their wing. And I guess when he first got out of prison, you have to have a job. So the Star offered him a job, and sounds like they gave him to you. Is that right, Harry?
Yeah. Well, I asked for him. I had become fascinated with prisons, and I wanted to do a series of articles about all the prisons in Missouri and Kansas. But I needed something different to use. And the Washington Post had run a great series by Ben Bagdakian, one of their famous reporters. And his gimmick was he had managed to get the Attorney General of Pennsylvania to get him into a prison as a prisoner for 6 days to pose as a prisoner. And he used that as the wedge to get into his story. And I thought I've got to outdo Bagdakian. And the only way I could think of was to talk the paper into hiring Joe and letting him be my mentor on prisons while I taught him how to be a reporter. And it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, because he was the kind of guy would go in one of those clubs down in the River Key that might be mob connected and who would have friends out of the penitentiary that would be in there, and they could kind of give him the real scoop, much better than the police.
Freddie Bonadonna is dead, is he not?
Yeah, he committed suicide in 2013, actually, down in Naples, Florida. He had a witness protection program that sent him down there, and I understand he'd opened a restaurant down there and was doing okay. He'd slipped back in town a few times.
Was it called Freddie's Place?
No, it was Poor Freddie's.
Oh.
down in
Naples, Florida.
Go ahead.
Freddie became Joe's informant. I mean, that's how Joe did such a good job on the River Key, mainly because he like you say, he'd get around. He was street smart, lots more than I am, or was. And he got somehow he got Freddie talking to him, and it was really incredible help in figuring everything out. In fact, he and I both ended up pretty well hated. The mob hated him more than they did me, because they reviewed him as a turncoat. I was just another grubby ass reporter, but he'd serve time.
Well, I can understand that.
We went one night down to the Three Little Pigs. You remember that?
Oh, restaurant? Yeah, Scola's place.
Yeah. It's where the mob usually, the various people from the various bars would gather after the bars closed. So we thought we'd go down there and just see what happened. And the animosity that we felt from the crowd was terrific. But it was Joe that they seemed to want to really hated. I'll never forget that night. It was a very strange and scary evening.
I'll bet. Late at like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and you're down there. And
yeah.
All those mob guys that got off their, closed down their bars and congregated.
Exactly. That was. I don't think I would have had the nerve to do it if Joe went along. And I think maybe Joe needed me to protect him a little bit from. There were some really. I think he felt quite threatened at times from this whole thing.
Let's see. JJ had a book. I doubt if it's even. I don't know if you can still buy it. I have a copy of it. It's called "I Speak for the Dead." Is that correct?
Yeah. I'm in there. One of the characters.
Yeah. It's kind of what we would call a historical fiction. I think it's all based on real people, but he wrote it in as if it was a fiction book. I doubt, I don't know, we have listeners out there that will probably be Googling it. I don't know if it's out there. It is an interesting book written by this J.J. Mahoney called I Speak for the Dead. I think, we had the little war, the mob war between the Spiro brothers, Carl Spiro and Mike and Joe.
Yeah.
And I think J.J. knew Carl Spiro could go talk to him. But I don't know, it may have been just bumping into him in a bar or something. Carl probably didn't really tell him anything. I have some vague memory that they didn't know each other, but they'd both been in the penitentiary, Carl in Kansas and JJ in Jefferson City here in Missouri, but they had that kind of shared background. That's pretty unusual to have a major newspaper have a reporter with his history, and it worked out for him. He had a 15-year career or so.
Yeah, he was a damn good reporter, he went on to California and won some awards there too. On the Orange County Register, I think it was.
So, but once he came out, even he might have been on probation, you gave him a job. He got off of probation, obviously, because he went to California then at some point. So he, it really turned his life around from a life of crime.
Bond finally gave him a pardon, as I recall.
Oh, okay.
Governor Bond.
Because maybe that was part of the resentment was, here's these guys, they're living a life of crime. I mean, I think they love it, but nonetheless, they still, I think, long for that straight life.
I don't know
about that, Aaron. I think it's too boring for them. They like the excitement. JJ, JJ might not have gone straight, except he had an exciting job where he could brush.
He could go back and report on the same guys that he knew about.
He could go out to the same joints and brush elbows with the same guys and just kind of from the other, kind of like being a policeman, kind of the only difference in between a policeman and being a professional criminal is a pretty fine line, I think, sometimes. Action.
He could go out like Gary would tell these stories about going and having to go down like to the River Quay to check out some of these adult establishments undercover, of course, having a few beers, watching the show, making sure there wasn't actually a donkey in the building.
Well, yeah, I did a little bit of that, but anyhow, moving right along. Well,
frankly, I was a lot more afraid for him than I was for myself, as far as danger.
Yeah, I can understand that. Let's talk about sources, and let's talk about Jerry Brooks. We got to tell this Jerry Brooks story. I've never really told this in the podcast. He's Jerry Brooks was a guy who first came to light when the ATF investigated a right-wing group called the Minutemen, and was led by a guy named Robert Depew. Now, did you investigate that when they first arrested ATF arrested Robert Depew? Is that when you first met Jerry Brooks?
Yeah. I wrote a book about the Minutemen.
Oh, did you?
Jerry's one of the main characters in the book.
What's the title of the book?
The Minutemen.
Oh, the Minutemen. Okay,
it was published by Doubleday in 1968, and then it was turned into a paperback in 1969 under the title of Private Army. The paperback I had was able to update it by a year, a very important year in which Depew was finally arrested and found. After he'd gone become a fugitive for 17 months, they finally found him down in New Mexico, and I was able to get that into the paperback. So, but if you want to read the whole thing, you can find both books on sale.
Oh, great! Now
on the internet,
remind me about Robert Depew. What was his exact thing? I know he had ATF was an investigating agency, so it had something to do with guns, and he was a right wing.
He was the son of a Jackson County deputy sheriff, and he became a chemist. He studied chemistry, and he opened a little business in Northern Missouri, making pills for animals, and it was a pretty good going little business. But in the meantime, he had become a right wing zealot, turned on especially at first by the Cuba and the Castro phenomena, and he decided in 1961 to start building this organization, and it got fairly big. I think there's never been able to say how many exactly, but I would say that at least they had 2,000 members. They spread all the way from coast to coast. I was able to write the book because in 19 Minutemen were arrested in New York City as they were early morning arrest as they were getting ready to go out and attack some left wing camps to attack them and blow them up and so forth. Anyway, that made the front page of the New York Times and all the New York papers for about a week. And that's how I was able to sell this whole thing to Doubleday. Pew ended up dying at the age of 86 and alone. His wife had left him. His children were gone. I don't know if his children, I think, were just estranged from them. And he had ALS, and he was just a very pitiful man who died.
So back to Jerry Brooks. So now, how did you first stumble across Jerry Brooks in the middle of writing this article?
The Minutemen first came to our attention when they went down to the Liberty Memorial to picket, because the Liberty Memorial at that time was flying the flags of all the members of the United Nations, and they didn't like that because that included Russia, and so they picketed.
So let's get started with tell us about the first time that you met Jerry Brooks.
I don't remember exactly. I think it was at one of these demonstrations, picketing Liberty Memorial. But he came to me he became a source of information, and he usually kind of appreciated a handout of some sort. And I dipped into my pocket a time or two to help him, as did police officers and FBI and ATF and God knows all the other people he would talk to.
Yeah,
he was an amazing.
He was. He told one story.
Guy.
He was an amazing guy. He told one story about how he took a bus around the country to do reconnaissance for Robert Depew and the Minutemen to pick out targets they may want to bomb.
And what, all of them were close to a Greyhound station.
Yeah, really. But Jerry had almost a photographic memory too. He did not shower regularly many times, and when you talk to him, he had this kind of goofy voice, And he had kind of a goofy look, like he was just a street person. And you just, anybody, most people just walk right by him or dismiss him when they first encountered him until you got to know a little bit about him. So what is that your first impression of Jerry Brooks?
Oh, yeah. Well, he was sort of a street person, actually. He was just amazing to know a person. He would call my house, and if you got my wife or her daughter on the phone, you'd tell them a joke. And then I asked to talk to him. He kept me in touch with things that Depew was doing. Not necessarily. I mean, he was just a source of miscellaneous information.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how often he did this at Depew's behest. He may have been deliberately planning some stuff with me. I never knew. I never relied on him as a source that I quoted on anything, but he was just a good background guy. After the Minutemen, he ended up being chauffeur for Willie the Red Camisano. I mean, this is amazing.
I know. I once saw him engage with Snag Klein, talking to him, I think, at Winstead's restaurant or someplace like that. He like knew, you know, this is a Jewish gambler who was, had helped run the mob's wire service back in the 40s and 50s and participated in some election fraud things. And Jerry Brooks would,
Did time for him. Voter fraud.
He did. And Jerry Brooks was the kind of guy that could just go up and talk to him and ask him what's going on, what he's been doing. And then he'd turn around and tell the FBI or tell Harry Jones with the Star or Gary Jenkins with the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit. And
even when he was Willie Camisano's chauffeur.
Yeah.
He'd be like, oh, yeah, Willie and I went down to the car lot today.
He almost sounded like him.
Hey, you know, we were going to the strip club. We were there till 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
Boy, are my arms tired.
He was something, you know, and we'd give him like $5 and he was happy. And as inflation hit, then he wanted a little more. Matter of fact, the last time I saw Jerry Brooks, I first started practicing law after I left the police department and I was on Linwood and, you know, he always hung out over by the donut place, Lamar's Donuts. He had some connection with the people that owned Lamar's Donuts, and he was over there all the time. Yeah. And he saw my name on the sign out in front of this lawyer's office, and so he came in. You know, I said, "Hey, how you doing?" And I said, "Hey, good." And he said, "You know, can you loan me $20?" And I said, "Sure, Jerry, I'll give you $20." And I said, "Now you got to pay me back because, you know, I don't care about information now." And he said, "I'll pay you back next week," but. You know, he never did. How he was. If I ran into him, he would, if he had it, he would have given it to me, but, I didn't really care. I was just teasing him about giving it back to me. But I would call one of the guys back out the unit and I'd say, next time you talk to Brooks, remind him that he owes me $20 just to kind of keep him going. But he died. I don't know. He got cancer and died shortly after that. It didn't last too long, but he was the kind of guy that could drive, you know, one of the most feared mob guys around, Willie the Rat Camisano. He ended up driving him around. He didn't have any, you know, didn't have any part in the action, and Willie wouldn't tell him about anything, but here's one thing he did for us. He told us about a policeman who was hanging out at a body shop where Willie was hanging out that guy might check licenses and stuff for Willie. So we set him up. We put a trap in the computer and we sent a license through Jerry, who ended up giving it to Willie to see if he can get it checked out. And the guy checked it out too. So, I mean, that's the kind of guy he was. He could do that kind of stuff. You know, and he can remember a license plate and didn't have to write anything down. And he'd tell you that.
Oh, that was amazing. Where he could do that.
I know. He was something else. I was telling Harry, and I'll tell you guys out there, it's be a repeat for Harry, but here's an interesting thing about our mutual source. And this is, you know, when you work, you know, whether you're working, you're a policeman and you really do a lot of investigating, need a lot of sources, or you're a newspaper reporter, you run into guys like this. And they're just these weird, strange little people who seem to be into everywhere and into everything or know something or, you know, and, I don't know for their own ego why they do it, but they like the action or something. They like being connected to something else. I'm not sure why they do it. But he was that kind of guy. But when he died, I got a call from somebody and they said, did you know Jerry Brooks died? I said, yeah. He said, the guy says, did you know that he was buried in, I believe it was the name of that cemetery, Eden Cemetery up in, Chicago, the kind of the north side of Chicago. What the man told me is that Carl Peterson, who was the general manager of the Kansas City Chiefs, paid for his cemetery plot and his headstone. And Jerry never had anything. He never had two nickels to rub together. I found out the name of that cemetery and the phone number, and I called up there, and the guy said, oh, yeah, yeah. He said a guy named Carl Peterson did pay for his tombstone. And he said, as a matter of fact, he said, you want to come and visit it? And, you know, it's I'll tell you where it is. And I said, well, you know, I have to come to Chicago. So I went to Chicago for a visit my aunt shortly thereafter, and I went out, and there was Jerry Brooks's tombstone, and it had a Kansas City Chiefs logo on it. And so I kind of assume, I mean, it's too good of a story. I'd love to find this Carl Peterson and ask him what the deal was, wouldn't you, Harry?
Yeah, is he alive, I wonder?
Yeah, he is. He is. I think he may still live in Kansas City. I've asked a couple of people about him, and people that should know, and they said, yeah, they're pretty sure he still lives here. I thought he lived in one of the condos down in the plaza, but maybe I can't find anybody that knows him.
Maybe he drove for him.
He could have driven for him.
Could be.
Although a guy like Carl Peterson would probably not have a guy like Jerry Brooks driving for him. He'd be a little bit goofy and stinky with his highfalutin friends. There's a story there. Who knows what it is? Either that or Jerry somehow had some money and he manufactured that story. You know, he was probably capable of that, too. Just to have a good story about his death.
Oh, I was just thinking, you know, if Jerry didn't take baths, they were probably, and he's driving Willie Camisano around, and they're like, I smell a rat. And they're like, well, no, that's just Jerry. He hasn't bathed.
Drum roll, please. Well, Harry, I think we're probably about to the end of this. I appreciate that you called in, and I appreciate your work and our kind of.
I don't feel like I've been very interesting, but
well, you have. You've been more interesting. I will. I'll edit this down into something, and I'll send you an email a copy of the final interview, so you'll be able to hear it. And if you want, I'll send you a copy of Bill Norton's too. You'd probably be interested in that.
That'd be great. Sure.
Kind of, yeah. I'm just looking back at the notes I'd taken from our conversation, and I'm just thinking because we had talked with Bill, and I don't know if the order of these are going to come out where this will come out before Bill because you kind of predated Bill, but Bill had some great stories, and obviously you do too. I'm just wondering, when you left the Star there, did you feel like, oh man, I just missed a great story because the Argent case came up and. Like all that news broke out.
I'll tell you. Well, I left for a lot of reasons, but I never regretted having left.
All right, Harry, it's been a pleasure talking to you. We will let you get on with your dinner tonight.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Good night, Harry.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, Aaron, that was a blast way back in the past. Yeah. There's one of the pioneers of
the newspaper industry.
Post-war, shall we say, the post-war investigative journalism was one of the founding members of IRE, Investigative Reporters and Editors, which is today, I checked them out, and today it's really morphed into more of a document gathering and assist and investigative reporters finding and obtaining documents from governmental agencies is what it's kind of morphed into.
And then sharing that.
And sharing those documents around. So it's still a vital going thing in any of your cities out there. If you've got a guy that does kind of the government investigation thing and there's not so much mob stuff anymore, there is still some, but anybody that does any kind of in-depth investigations, they're going to belong to IRE, and they will have used IRE. I say IRE. They always say IRE in their ability to gather documents and share documents and have things help reporters from one city, you know, connect with reporters from another city to follow leads up. So it's a pretty important thing, the whole newspaper, the fifth estate, shall we say, whether it be TV or newspapers are pretty important. Arm of the thin blue line of civilization between civilization and anarchy out there.
Well, I mean the public, to the degree that they may have a fascination with this, there's no real source material from the mob.
No,
they're not publishing. I mean, the people that go into witness protection, you know, and come out on the other side and publish a book, Red Womette. Now, you know, those folks, Frank Culotta, but otherwise, you know, it's a wall of silence.
Yeah. And that's a real recent phenomenon. That only happened in the last few years. Before that, there was no mob guys that wrote a book. Like, they may allow themselves to be interviewed by a reporter. Like, was it Peter Moss wrote a story on Joe Valachi, though? Over Damaris, I think, called the Greenfelt Jungle, some of the early mob books in the 50s and 60s. But that's having the mobsters themselves write books is a real recent phenomenon. Yeah, so thank God for these newspaper reporters.
Those guys getting out there in the trenches and, I mean, putting their lives on the line.
Yeah, really. I mean, they kind of do. I understand they're protected in a way, but.
I mean, when you think about how many cops died as a result of investigations, there weren't a lot.
Not many.
But there weren't a lot of reporters that were killed as well.
Yeah, and John Drummond talks about a couple in Chicago, kind of go back a ways, and one of them was on the payroll of Al Capone, and then we had this Don Bowles down in
Arizona,
Phoenix, and that's pretty much been it that I've ever heard of.
And it sounds like from Harry Jones' account that wasn't mob related.
Oh, the Don Bowles killing?
Yeah.
You know, it was...
nothing worse. The only thing worse than a mob killing would be a developer killing.
Really? Well, it was a crime. It was a crime-related killing. It wasn't mafia.
Don't stand in the way of development.
Really? That's what he did. He hired this Ross, or was it Ross? This John Adamson dude to plant a bomb on him, and he got somebody his to help. It's kind of a two-bit, small-time deal, really. And then as soon as they got caught, they broke down and went and served their time. But they refused to implicate the guy that paid them. You gotta hand them that. And they didn't do a whole lot of time. They ended up getting their convictions overturned in the end anyhow. That's probably because of that rich developer that paid them off, probably using political connections to get them out.
Yeah, but maybe that was also one of the reasons they didn't talk, because if this guy paid them to kill somebody else,
yes.
What's to say he's not just going to pay somebody to kill them?
But, you know, those reporters at the time that went down there, they said they had a little slogan was that just because you kill a reporter doesn't stop us from reporting. So that was the statement they wanted to make when they had that Arizona project. And they came from all over the United States and just flooded into Phoenix area. And just, I mean, they interviewed everybody down there that had anything to do with any kind of criminal activity, and then wrote stories on it and got them on the nationwide, UPI and AP.
On the Newswire.
And the Newswire and the New York Times and the Washington Post and all the big national publications. So that's, they needed to make a point. They need to say, stand up for one of their own. You have to admire that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you look at the chilling effect that it would have on reporting when somebody was killed, and at that time, that not a very prominent thing. But you look in modern times, like now,
I think the president saying hashtag fake news has a chilling effect. Kill one of those reporters, and then you'll see a chilling effect.
But you look in like Mexico.
Oh yeah, they're killing reporters all over the place.
Killing reporters, bloggers, you know, there over in the Middle East, there, you know, a number of journalists, national AP, Reuters, those kind of journalists being captured and tortured or killed.
Right.
Yeah, by extremists.
Was it Dan Pearl, I think, was that one? Not his name in Pakistan. They set him up. He was trying to interview, I think, Osama bin Laden or somebody like that, one of the higher-up terrorists, and they set him up saying, you know, we can get you an interview with him, and then killed him. So, yeah, it's a definite chilling effect.
Maybe the mob lived by a set of rules, and even you as a police officer knew what those rules were, and today it doesn't sound like those rules apply.
And they don't apply with the in other countries with the Mexican and the Colombian cartels, and they don't apply with the ISIS and the Al Qaeda and the other Middle Eastern
extremists.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, probably they may not apply to extremists here in the United States. I'd be kind of careful if I were a reporter, if I was reporting on extremists. You know what I say? Those are the people that scare me because they think they're right.
Yeah.
And the mob knows they're wrong. They know they're breaking the law. They understand the game. Those terrorists and those extremists, they think they're right,
yeah.
And you're wrong. And if you're not with them, you're wrong, and you're the enemy. So whether you're a cop or a citizen or a reporter or whatever, so those are the guys that scare me.
Which has got to be hard to do.
Scare me.
To scare you. I'm pretty easily scared.
I'm a human being. But I can be scared. I just figured out how to maintain and overcome it and go charge on through it. That's the only difference. I'm still scared.
Well, the one thing you're not scared of doing is doing your public service announcement.
If you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to go out and get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase on Amazon. You don't want to rent this because you're going to want to watch this over and over again. Then you're going to get the app that started it all, Kansas City Mob Tour. That's right. If you want to take a tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City for $1.99, download onto your iPhone the Kansas City Mob Tour. And when you're walking around town, you can listen to over 150 free Gangland Wire podcast episodes. And you're going to want to read Gary's latest book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And when you're reading that, from the words written, transcribed from the wiretaps of the Argent case, you're going to get so excited about this truth that you're going to want to download the Kindle version, which has hyperlinks to the actual audio from the mouth of the men that did it. Other than that, folks, what you need to do is put a hit out on our donate button, help support Gangland Wire and the free episodes we're bringing to you.
That's for sure, folks. We can always use a donation. We need to pay the studio rent, and we've bought a little equipment from some of your contributions, and we appreciate that.
Every month it costs to host the podcast. The app costs money every month.
Right.
And we're just putting that in ourselves. We're all right with that.
And the website.
And the website. And for you.
And one of these days, maybe we'll make a little money for our time spent, but we're, you know, this is like a labor of love. We like doing this.
I like to tell Gary that, you know, he always wanted to have one last mission.
Yeah, this is my last mission.
Maybe there's another one out there, but this is a pretty good last mission. Talking with people,
you've got me on one last mission. We're getting lined up to go up to the penitentiary and interview a guy. That's going to be my last mission. I don't like going into those penitentiaries, Aaron. I'll tell you right now.
I bet. You don't ever have a choice to get out.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Sorry. No story there. No.
Seems like, you know, when you're a reporter and you're covering these stories, and, you know, over the years, the stories, like, you have those kind of high moments in your life. I think Bill Norton, this certainly was one for him. And so I just was kind of curious if maybe you were, not why you left the Star, but rather if you probably still paid attention to what was going on in town.
Sure. Yeah, the Leon Jordan murder and all that, that's been fascinating to follow ever since.
Yeah, they finally kind of solved that in a way, in a roundabout way. That's folks, that's a murder of a real prominent African-American politician here in Kansas City, and he had been a Kansas City, Missouri police officer. I think he actually got up as high as lieutenant, had left the department, and he formed the preeminent black political club called Freedom Incorporated here in Kansas City that became probably the most powerful black political club, and was involved in that. He had a nightclub over on Prospect that was kind of the center of the black political community. Anybody who was anybody who wanted to get connections with black politicians would end up at the Green Duck Tavern. One night, Leon Jordan walked out and somebody drove up on him as he got to his car and killed him with a shotgun. And And that was what, I don't know, 40 years ago, 35 years ago. And just in the last few years, you know, I'm sure you covered that, Harry, at the time. And it was,
I think it was after I left.
No, it was after you left. And so just in the last few years, an informant came forward who was the son of a, mob associate who had a, corner store in the 18th and Vine area, which is kind of the center of the black community at one point in our history in Kansas City. And he had connections with people who they said were the black mafia, what we call the black mafia. And I'll have to do a story on the black mafia. I know quite a little bit about that one of these days, but they're the ones who got a couple of their people to go out and kill Leon Jordan. And we think it was probably at the behest of the Northside Democratic Club, because he was kind of standing in some of their ways, I believe. And he had supposedly disrespected one of their members down at the state capitol not too long before that. So it was quite a story to have that all come out 25 or 30 years later.
Yeah.
Well, that's why you're a reporter, isn't it? 'Cause you love those stories.
Yeah.